What's going on, Curiosity Builders? I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative entrepreneurs, storytellers, visionaries, and changemakers who are on a mission of chasing big ideas, telling epic stories, and leaving living legacies. Whether you're just starting out or been at this creative and curious life for some time, I hope you'll learn something new in this podcast and find yourself inspired to break through the barriers that hold you back and keep you stuck from getting your work to work. Being someone who obsessively listens for and seeks out intriguing questions, it's fascinating when a simple question presents itself. Why not? Matt Wood is in the business of making why not happen through the creation of a unique type of visual language for brands looking for a competitive edge, brand illustration systems. In this conversation, Matt begins with the creative rebels, misfits, and pioneers who inspired him to become an artist. He also shares his creative journey, business epiphanies, the importance of keeping archives, and the power of art to evoke deep feelings. Show notes and links to all the good stuff mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/511. Well, Matt, welcome to Getting Work to Work. It is a pleasure to talk with you today.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Absolutely. And I love asking this question of everyone because the answers are, I mean, it's infinite what you can hear from someone. Yeah. But what are you endlessly curious about?
That's a really great question. I love it. I am infinitely interested in creative rebels, misfits, and pioneers of the past. Their vision, their challenges, their successes, and their impact, and also the longevity of the things that they did and how they affected the future that was ahead of them.
Yeah. So who's on that list of creative rebels and misfits for you?
I've got a couple of decades to cover here, so let me throw some things at you.
You've got time.
The first thing that I'm really super interested in that I stumbled across, there's a YouTube channel called The Cinema Cartography. They do video essays. And the one that I've been the most intrigued by is about 13 minutes long, so it's easily consumable. And it talks about the French New Wave film movement in the 50s and the 60s. Mm-hmm. And so it's the creation of the auteurs. There's four directors at that point that I can't remember their names. They're all French filmmakers, and I can't remember their names. But they call them the Young Turks. And they go through like a really quick presentation of how they changed film and the ways that they approached film and the ways that they saw film. And one of the great quotes is that from that time, one of these directors said, "Photography is truth and cinema is truth 24 times a second."
I love that.
How they changed editing and how they changed storytelling and how they changed so many different things, camera movement, experimenting with angles and tracking, playing with the frame. It's fantastic stuff, man. I'm just like, I'm intrigued. It's like snapshots in the middle of a film that we just like freeze frame and do a snapshot.
Yeah.
Or breaking the fourth wall or non sequiturs. This is so innovative that it just, I'm looking at something from the 50s and 60s, making me think about today and what can change today? What can I do today to change something? So that's one.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I love the cinema is telling the truth 24 frames a second. And I've heard the other side of that from Ken Burns, the documentary filmmaker, who said that cinema is lying 24 frames a second.
Yeah. Whose truth are you talking about?
Exactly.
So that's an example. And I've got a few more. I've got, from the 70s. And not all of these are like my complete cup of tea, but I really appreciate that they broke some molds and that they all of a sudden started something brand new. But from the 70s, Monty Python, just sort of the iconic sort of feel of that troupe and the originality that they came up with, and they were able to tackle comedy and political topics and religious topics at the time. that was pretty interesting stuff. And then go from a television show and little shorts and stuff to making feature films. Mm-hmm. Just, a real wall breaker. That to me was just amazing. For the 90s, it was David Carson.
Okay, yeah.
With his design and topography revolution stuff. And his work with Ray Gun magazine, which I I did some looking into and stuff, and there's a mention of it, I think it's on Wikipedia, that at one point in Reagan magazine, they did an interview with Brian Ferry, and the interview consisted entirely, they wrote the entire interview entirely in the symbol font, Zapf Dingbat.
Yes.
It's like, it's intelligible, right? You can't read it. And I'm like, who does that?
Uh-huh.
You know, but they did it. And I'm like, why not? So it's that kind of stuff that just blows me away. And it inspires me to ask questions about what's going on right now that we're just taking for granted. And I guess the last one that's like recent is the things that are making a big difference for me and the things that are the most exciting for me. Because, you know, a lot of people talk for a lot of years that, you know, our attention spans are starting to disappear. Mm-hmm. I felt like if that's the truth, man, we got to change that. And then all of a sudden we've got these long form podcasts with Joe Rogan and with Lex Fridman. They're like 3 and 4 hours long, man. I'll consume those things. I'll sit here and work all night long and listen to those. And that seems to be a new thing. You know, people that were brave enough to try something new and say, I'm not going to do something that's a soundbite. I want to ask more questions.
Yeah.
All of these creative rebels.
That's awesome. And, you know, touching back on that David Carson story, again, I love that story so much. And I was ready to like ask you if you had heard that story when you brought up Zapf Dingbat. And I think I remember at one point he said that the interview was so boring, the only option that he really had was to put it in that font.
I'm so intrigued by people who are ready to do something that no one has ever done, because I want to get back in their shoes the day they did it and say, how do you feel right now?
Yeah.
Because like they're probably sitting there going, well, we could do this. And then someone said, but we could also do this. Mm-hmm. And someone said, you know, Zapf Dingbats, what are you talking about? And it's that moment where they said, why not?
Yeah.
I think that's what I'm always looking for, that moment where someone says, why not?
Yeah. Because what's interesting is I think the trajectory of business and creativity in general is I think we start with that philosophy of why not and being the rebel.
Yeah.
And then I think over the years, we kind of lose that edge and we lose that passion to say why not. And we'll be like, what do you mean why not? You know, we almost replace it with the desperate why not from the client. Why not? Why won't you? And then we almost have to find it again on the other side.
Well, you know, our livelihoods depend on it. I mean, we can't be, you know, we can't be the rebel 24 hours a day. I think that we have a responsibility to our clients to deliver something that's, you know, viable. I mean, you're not going to deliver an entire prospectus for a corporation, you know, in Zapf Dingbats. So, you know, we have to do what's right for them. And to a certain extent, I think maybe that's okay, because I think it takes a little bit of that. What do you call that? The person that's just following the rules. It takes a bit of that to kind of get you edgy again, to make you realize that, you know, it's time for me to maybe ask some bigger questions. Or there's one thing when I was mostly focused on design, and graphic design and art direction, whenever I would kind of give a presentation, I mean, there was always the common thing is to like, you're going to be giving the client 3 iterations of a pitch. Right. And the one thing that I added into that was a 4th iteration that was completely off the cuff. And I made a practice of doing that and had nothing to do with what everybody was telling me was going to work. It had everything to do with my passion. And I would always add that in at the end. And it's not that every time that they would take it, but the stories of the people that did are the ones that stand out.
I love that so much, because there's the experience of grounding yourself in reality, but creating an environment to where the rebel can also survive and thrive.
Yeah. Well, why not? Right.
Yeah. Well said. Why not?
Yeah. Why not?
So Matt, you've been creating editorial illustration and telling stories now for over 20 years. Yeah. Like, what got you into illustration and design in the first place?
Well, I grew up in a family that was artistic, and it was just an aptitude for us. I don't think any of us were scared to make art. And, and we were always, you know, from grade school on up, all of my siblings and I, we were the kids that could draw, right? Mm-hmm. So first of all, that's in our genes, I guess. And the next answer is really kind of interesting, or might be interesting to everybody, and I don't even know if this exists anymore. But Reader's Digest,
yeah,
got me to cross the line. It was in the 80s. I was a kid, and I was doing my own drawings and stuff, and I was always interested in design, but I didn't know what I was looking at. Like, you know, mm-hmm. I would see design in specific publications that were very interesting and just drew my eye, and there was an aesthetic, but I couldn't put my finger on what I was looking at. Hmm. I remember the specific moment that at some point I was just looking through a Reader's Digest and I saw an illustration that grabbed my attention, and I was staring at it and I thought, wow, this is great, man. This is amazing. And then I recognized that there was a byline stuck in the corner. So it told me who the illustration was done by. And it just clicked. And I thought, people do this for a living. People are actually hired to do this. And I looked at the design itself in the magazine, and I thought, if someone's doing the art, someone's doing the design. Mm. And seeing those two things together as a kid, you know, probably maybe like 13, maybe, that's what I want to do. Like, this is communications. This is art. This is a craft. This is, you know, It's the 80s. Everything is still analog. I come from the analog days. So mm-hmm. It was just like this exciting experience. And all of a sudden, everything I saw, everything opened up. And I started grabbing everything. And like, someone designed this. Someone drew this. Someone chose this photography. Someone, you know, it was just an instant passion. So I think that's where it came from.
That's really interesting. And as a 13-year-old kid, what do you do with that?
Well, you start looking at everything. I don't think that there was ever a magazine. Like, you take me to the grocery store and I'm in the magazine aisle, right? And so you've got a 13 or 14 year old kid looking at every magazine possible and staring at how they solved this, they solved the solution. They cracked the code to how to tell a story, or they, you know, use photography to back up what they were talking about, or a headline, or the font usage, and I was just, all of a sudden it just started to just pour in, and I just started to collect and I started to consume. So
yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah. I too loved the magazine aisle as a kid, and I'll never forget when Wired magazine came out and changed the game for me.
Yes, yes, Wired, and Fast Company. Mm-hmm. Yep, those were huge for me.
Yeah, and what I loved about Wired, it wasn't just the design, but it was the inks and the different styles of printing that they used that for me was just so unbelievably cool.
Right. Yeah, you start, you know, if you're picking up some of the, maybe the Dwell magazines, or it's the higher end magazines that have the better paper. Mm-hmm. And you know, the photography is a lot more crisp. You know, the dot gain on the sheet isn't, you know, so spread out. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, all of a sudden you have this entirely different experience. You can pick up the cheap rag, or you can pick up the expensive thing, and you just feel it in your hands. And it started to change my world, because I felt like, you know, I can communicate with the world like this. I can change the world. I mean, there's, you know, you look at the newsstand and it's not just one magazine. It's like, you know, there's one magazine, but it's printed, you know, 30 times sitting there. So, you know, it's a medium that can change the world. There's going to be a lot of it out there. So.
And I love that you started with the analog world too, because, you know, much like getting the tactile nature of paper, you're getting that friction as you take a pencil across, you know, paper and all of these things. And I think that to some degree, it makes it more real. At least this is me nostalgically saying that it makes it more real than digital is.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's, that has to have like an influence on what you end up illustrating and saying.
Yeah, it does. I feel like going back to the analog discussion here, in the analog time, I guess, things were not easy. if you wanted to do photography, you needed to wait to see what you got back. There were so many restrictions, which at first, you know, maybe we look back and just think, you know, let's just slow everything down, which is fine. But what it did was, you know, what, necessity is the mother of invention. So to come up with a new technique, I mean, you would grab a toilet paper roll and stick it over the camera so that you could get sort of like a different view out the end of your SLR. You know, so you're creating almost anything that you want to make. If you have a vision for something or discovering something on the fly, it required you to come up with solutions. And in that process, you were coming up with brand new ways of seeing. So I think that was the gift back then. Mm-hmm. Whereas now, I mean, there's access to almost everything. And I don't know, I hate to say that we're all getting bored or that we've run out of ideas, mm-hmm. but I doubt that we're ever running out to the shed to try to find some tool to get something figured out that we can't figure out with a filter or a new plugin somewhere. So.
Right. Yeah. I just love the mental image of you running out to the shed to like grab something right now. That's awesome.
How can I fix this? How can I fix this?
That's right. Cause this is like, there's something to be said about the whole, there's the figure of speech, like going to the woodshed to practice.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the garage band, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah. All of my creative misfits that I loved as a kid and as an adult, they all started in the garage, whether it was a band or a company.
Well, so I think when you're dealing with real tools, when you're dealing with something that's in a physical space, mm-hmm. it just engages so many senses. Or I can go out and I'm not a great handyman, but if there's a problem to be solved, I can pretty much find almost everything I need in a pile of junk to fix what I need. Because
is a gift.
I'll jerry-rig something, man.
That is an absolute gift.
Yeah.
So going from illustration and design, was it a natural move for you to get interested in business?
Going from design into illustration was my path. Mm-hmm. And my path from design into illustration is kind of strange because I started out, like I said, looking in this magazine and seeing that there's illustration, and that's what caught my eye. But it was also just how the design around that actually fit into place. Mm. The one physical place that I could actually take on design in an analog world, especially as a kid growing up, because I hadn't even graduated yet. But by the time I got into the grades where you were actually putting together a yearbook, I signed up to get that under my belt to try to figure out how to design a yearbook. And so I discovered that, you know, the design process is a choice making process. And I got to choose for everyone for infinity what got into that yearbook and what didn't. I was the gatekeeper. And so I can say whatever I needed to. So that was my foray into doing design. And then that moved on into an actual career with graphic design and doing stuff. But after a few years, I really started to lean back into, because I was constantly illustrating. I was, you know, doing my own artwork and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I was finding opportunities whenever I was doing the design work to drop in art, mm-hmm. It was just the next level. So mm-hmm. design is one level of communication where illustration itself has so many aspects. It's the chocolate mousse of all the things that you could possibly eat from. It's just so rich and it's so textured and nuanced. I started to lean more into that, and I started to make my own art and include it in the things I was doing. And the thing that really just kind of like snapped the rubber band for me, and it was over between myself and design and art direction and graphic design, was when I figured out that making illustration, editorial illustration for magazines, paid a hell of a lot better than graphic design. And it paid quickly, and it was the thing that I loved to do, and it just had more bang for the buck. And that's when I realized I don't have to deal with deadlines, I don't have to deal with clients that are making changes, and I don't have to sweat a press check. And, you know, one thing is wrong, you know, we have to scrap the entire thing and I could take a big hit. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of stress. And so I just laid it down and I just decided, you know, it's time for me to really change my communication methods in the direction of illustration. So that's when I made the switch.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And yeah. I love that you touched on, it was twofold. It was moving away from unnecessary stress, but also moving toward love, the things that you were enjoying more than just the things that you knew would maybe pay. Or yeah, there's a risk going in the direction of illustration, but at the same time, it sounds like the reward was worth the risk.
It was. It's more than love. It's like a. It was jumping into something that felt like this is what I was made for. I was made to be an illustrator. I probably was doing graphic design because it was the only thing that I knew was actual. I can walk in and get a job doing that. I can sit down at a desk doing that. I can get a steady paycheck doing that. Where illustration was just sort of like that extra little cherry on top. But once I started to realize that, you know, illustration is work too. Just someone's not going to hire you to do it. Yeah. You know, they're not going to be, it's not a 9-to-5 job. It's going to be you getting out there and doing it on your own. Mm-hmm. And it didn't matter to me. At that point, I was like, I can do this. So it was one of those things where when it finally kicked in, how much money I could make and how fast I could make it and how many great people I could work with, I was just done. It was over. I don't think I even looked back for a second. It was just over.
Did you have a lot of encouragement growing up and through your formative years that when you finally made this shift, you didn't have to think twice. You had that confidence in yourself because of those, you know, familial relationships.
Yeah. Encouragement, as far as encouragement, like early on as a kid, you know, I was the kid, like I said, our family was just artistic. It was just in our genes. And so anywhere I went, I was constantly drawing. And as a little kid, I mean, people are just like, oh my God, you know, what are you doing? I'm drawing an image of something and they're just instantly captivated. So that's attention in itself that, you know, kind of, it's a feedback loop. And I enjoy the intention, but I didn't draw because of the intention. Attention. It was just me, you know, doing the thing that I wanted to do and express myself. But I realized that it made a difference. You know, people would pay attention. And then later on, you know, as I'm getting older and I'm starting to hit my middle school years or getting, you know, just into high school. I think I mentioned at some point my older brother and my mom were at home. And I don't know how the topic came up, but it was like, you know, what do you think you want to do? And at that stage, I had already decided that art was going to be my career in some fashion. And so I said that, you know, I said, I really want to make art a career choice. And the first response, which any parent is going to say is, you know, that sounds great, but, you know, you should probably have some kind of a fallback. And my situation where I grew up was that, you know, I grew up in Nevada and the little town that I was in had no opportunity. Mm. We had no connections. You know, my family wasn't well off. Mm-hmm. And there really, in my mind's eye, there wasn't a future. And so, you know, put yourself in the place where you don't know that there can be a future and then throw a passion into your heart that you can't get rid of. And you know that that's going to be your way out. You're going to fight. Like no one's going to put that out. Like everything around you is insisting that your life just gets winked out and that you just give up. But this one thing that you want to hold on to is the thing that you're just not going to let go of. And my response to, you know, yeah, that sounds great, but you should have a backup was, you're not going to tell me that I can't do this. I was adamant, you know, with a few choice words. It was, it was like, this will happen. And a lot of years later, when I was finally on my own, probably with my business and had gone through a couple of stints at design agencies. And I remember talking to both my brother and my mom, and both of them said, I still remember that day. Both of them did. Hmm. And they said, we were wrong. You knew what you wanted. And that's exactly what you did. So, yeah, I mean, the encouragement was always there, but you know, there were also obstacles to overcome, but you know, those eventually make you stronger. But if you're going through them at the time, it's not fun, but no. You know, you do what you got to do. And maybe at the end you can look back and realize that that's all fuel too. You know, even the bad stuff is good. So
I'm curious. I mean, being in business for over 20 years, I mean, inevitably you're going to have a collection of good stories and bad stories. Yeah. What would you say has been the hardest lesson you've had to learn in that time?
You know, so many, you know, there's probably a few, and maybe my first one is, you know, you don't ever put all your eggs in one basket. Yes. That's the rule, right?
Right.
But you know, if you're on your own and you're working on your own and you find a cash cow and everything is going great and they're feeding you so much work that you can't break free to actually pick up any extra work, sometimes it doesn't feel like a choice. Like it's just handed to you. And, you know, it's fantastic to really find clients like that, that are keeping you busy and you've got an excellent relationship that just keeps growing and growing and growing. But you know, life happens and things change. And you've got to be aware that you can't ride that to the bank all the time and expect that things will always stay the same. Something can happen. And in my instance, I had a company like that that I was working with. It was a publishing company. And I was not only working on magazines, but I was working making product, and they had curriculum that they were sending out, and it just utilized every bit of my talent on every level. And I worked with so many different people there, and things were going great guns. And then all of a sudden it just ended without any fanfare or anything, and without any prior expectation that this is going to happen. And in one day I made a phone call and finally followed up. I mean, the work was just kind of like stretching out and I wasn't hearing back. And one phone call, I find out that 70% of my income is gone in a day. Wow. Because they've restructured and they have to do something else. And, you know, prior to that, I had realized that I had a lot of eggs in that basket. So I think I had maybe 2 years in advance to get myself out of that situation. My wife is my bookkeeper. And she said, do you realize that, you know, the company's probably doing about 90% of your work.
Wow.
And I thought, that's not cool. So I, even though I was super busy, I started to reach out and I started to spread the net. So, so don't put all your eggs in one basket. I think that's probably my main thing.
That's a fantastic lesson to learn, whether you've gone through it yourself or you're hearing this for the first time.
Yeah.
Pay attention to Matt right now, because in many ways we've all been there.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, when you go through a hard lesson, do you have a certain way of responding on the other end?
First, tears.
Naturally.
Anger. You know, you go through all of the stages, right? I don't know if I do. I guess I just get on with getting on. I can't say that I have some sort of magic resilience that pops me back up. I'm just determined. It's kind of like that, you know, like when my family said, you know, yeah, art sounds great, but you should probably have a backup. You know, it's like, I just have this passion that nothing's going to stop me. Like I'm just going to continue to get this thing done. I have the talent. I just need the connections. I need that community. And that's one of the other things too, that I wanted to share was, the hardest lesson too is isolation. Don't allow isolation to creep into your life. Whether it's on purpose or if you just lack knowing how to connect with other people, don't let isolation in your front door, because it's like fire in your house and it's a killer. Don't be disconnected from people. You really need to get connected. It's for yourself personally, and it's going to be for your craft and for the betterment of you personally. And it's also for your business and your success. Isolation is just a killer. Like I said, just don't let that get into your life.
I was thinking about 2020 and how many ways creative people in general have been hit by the realities of pandemic and changing business styles and all that. And I think for me, one of the biggest lessons was what you just said, not isolating yourself. And that's something that I did unintentionally for many years before leading up to this, where I just wasn't connecting in any way, really, until I think probably June or July of 2020. And that shifted for me. So thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a big deal. I know a lot of people struggle. There are introverts and extroverts, and that's a real thing. And it's, you know, as an artist, you're going to be spending more time alone than probably any other profession. You know, it's a solitary sort of thing. You know, you're staying up all night, or you're working alone on stuff and you have no one to bounce ideas off of or whatever it is. But there are so many opportunities now. During the pandemic, I just decided that it's worth my time to spend a little bit of money to maybe join this group or that group. Mm-hmm. And just to get out there and just to start meeting people and, you know, using my voice it came at a cost, because it was not only, you know, I maybe sign up for like a mastermind group or something like that. And it's, a lot of them aren't that expensive, but it also came at like something that I didn't want to do. Like my worst form of communication is sitting in front of my camera on my, on my computer on a Zoom call. I mean, it was just absolutely horrifying for me to do that. It just didn't feel right. I love talking with people, but I don't like talking to people on the screen. But I did it, and I kept doing it, and I kept doing it, and I kept doing it, and it took a long time where I finally just get to the stage now where it's fine. But it came at a cost because it was something I didn't want to do, but man, did it pay off. It really paid off. People need to know who you are and what you do, and they need to hear your story and your voice. So get out there.
One of the interesting things that you have the ability to do is you ask yourself the question, how do I live on this? Yeah. And what I love about that question is it has protected you from some of the fads that I think people get sucked into that are going to magically change your business.
Right.
And, you know, how did you discover that amazing question? Because I really do think it's a powerful one.
The one thing that I keep seeing happening, and it's maybe it's increasing, and I hope that it's not in certain senses. It's like, it feels like Blade Runner, right? You know, in Blade Runner, I mean, there's the holographic advertisements every square inch, and it's all trying to get your attention, and it's all filtered in fog, and, you know, it's deep in the dark city, and it's just, you know, whatever. But there's everybody trying to get your attention with every little product that they can put out, or every bit of content that teaches you how to make more content, or this is going to change your business, or this is going to up your social media, you know, numbers, or you're going to get more followers, or here's this thing for your business. And I get it. And it's not disparaging the actual content. There's probably a lot of really good stuff. But the one thing that wasn't clicking for me was, you know, if I spend this money and if I take this course, yes, I'll walk out knowing how to do this thing. But how does it fit into the overall machinery of my life and my business? Where does it go? I can pick up the most kick-ass carburetor from my local, you know, parts store, and someone could tell me this will just be awesome. But if I don't know the difference between that carburetor and whether it fits in my car or my model of car or how it's going to perform better in my car or what I want out of it or where I'm headed with that car, it's just another piece of something else. Mm-hmm. So I was constantly on the look for something that gave me the basics. You know, and I didn't even know what those basics were, but there's aversion to, I don't need all of these random pieces of information. And then I'm left with trying to piece them together. Like I know what I'm doing. I don't. I mean, after 25 years, I'm still trying to figure out exactly what all these pieces do together and how they get me from where I am to where I want to go. It's complicated. In my heart, I'm a communicator and I'm an artist and that's who I am, but I happen to run a business. But I'm not business first and art second. I'm still learning and I'm putting things together and getting out there into the real world and making connections finally got me to a place where I found some of those answers that really started to build the basic structure of where I'm headed today.
Wow, that's powerful.
Yeah.
One of the things that I appreciate too is the title that you're starting to call yourself to, a visioneer.
Yeah.
I love that. What do you mean by visioneer?
It was a process that I went through in this teaching course that I picked up. And the process is called Ikigai, and it takes you through a number of questions about yourself and what you're doing in the world and what you add to the world and what you feel like the world needs and what you can get paid doing. In the world, and you start to find your passion and you zero in, you know, you kind of go, you know, around the circumference of this thing and you get asked questions and you start to discover who you are and what you really are. And it boils down to coming up with at least a word that you can call yourself. And visioneer for me is visionary and pioneer. It's a combination of those two words. For me, that encapsulates what I feel like I've always been all of my life. I've had to be it because I had to get out of the situation that I was in as a kid. I had no other mentors around me to help me out through that situation. Mm-hmm. And again, you're in the analog years. I mean, if you wanted to call somebody, you looked them up in a phone book, a physical phone book, and you called them. And if they're long distance, they are long distance. You will get charges for that. And if you can't find somebody in New York to call because you're a designer or an illustrator and you think you have talent, how are you going to find them? So I think I was just going to make it. I saw where I was going to go and I knew what I wanted to do. And once I had clients, I really started to feel like it's my responsibility to not just do standard work, but like I said before, you know, give them three options in the standard feel of things where that's where you should be heading. And that's the responsible three iterations of an idea for the direction of their company. But I felt like, you know, why not add that fourth piece that says, and here's this thing that I came up with just because it's my passion. That's visioneering for me. That's showing someone what could possibly be that they've never seen before and taking them in a direction that you haven't been and they haven't been, and you'll discover together.
Mm, love it. Yeah. And that led you to what your core offering is going to be called Brand Illustration Systems.
Yeah.
What all goes into that?
I'll be honest with you. I don't know.
That's awesome.
And the reason that I don't know isn't because I'm not familiar with it or what's been happening in that field right now. I know what's happening in that field, but I'm not sure that I want to do the same. Mm. I know that there are components of it. You know, it's, you're going to be building a component of a brand system like any other component. You're going to, you know, for a brand system, you're always going to be choosing, you know, a color scheme, fonts and associated fonts. You're going to be coming up with copywriting. You're going to be coming up with photography. You're going to be coming up with, you know, there's like what, 9 or 10 different things that you're going to come up with to build a brand. But I haven't seen on that list a brand illustration system. I don't know if people understand the value that an illustration system can bring to a brand. Mm-hmm. People might think of photography first, but in photography, you can't make the same sort of imagery that you can in illustration. You can't tell a story the same way with photography. You can't bring excitement or style or it's just another component that fits into the overall scheme of someone's brand, and it's powerful. But I've seen people just build the basic sort of forms that, you know, it's on a hero page, it's on a landing page for somebody, a couple images of people using the product or looking happy, you know, building a product. Maybe it's in some of their print media or some of their advertisements. Maybe there's like, again, usually it's just people, you know, interacting or showing you what life would look like with this new product or whatever. And that's fine and good. There's nothing wrong with that. But I don't feel like that's what I want to do. I feel like I want to ask deeper questions. And I've had the opportunity now to work with a couple of companies. And I've brought some stuff to the table that has changed not only their mind about what they're doing, but about how they want to present themselves to the public. And that's just because we had a conversation about brand illustration systems.
Mm. Like when you're having that conversation about it, you know, like what are you saying and what are they saying and what's that conversation like?
For the ones that I've had so far, I come to the table first asking them what they do. And that's always the basic, you know, tell me about your business. And as they go through that entire process of telling me what they make and who their clients are and, you know, what their history is and, you know, maybe some of their competitors or how they want to be seen in their field, in their market, that's all well and good. I mean, those are all really, you know, those are the basic questions that you start getting a feel for where they're at. Mm-hmm. But the next questions I ask are, tell me about your clients. Tell me about what it means for you, for them to be interacting with you. As I start asking deeper questions about their relationship with their clients, we warm up to each other. You know, I'm talking with the client, we're warming up to each other. And at some stage I'll say, you've told me about your business and you've told me about your clients and you've told me about, you know, what they get out of your product, but are you in love with your clients? Mm-hmm. Tell me about the relationship you have with your clients. And I want to hear from somebody the story that makes me cry. I want them to be able to tell me something that they've done for someone else, specifically their client, that has meant so much to them that it's memorable, and that it's a personal connection with somebody. A product is fine. And, you know, a company will be paying me, but a company is made up of people. And of all those people, there are a couple in there that are stakeholders. And of the stakeholders, there's an owner, someone that really owns this thing. I want to make sure that this company turns into the company that they've always wanted. And I don't want to lose track of why they're there. And I don't want them to lose track of why they started and why they ever existed to start with. It's an alignment process. I know not every business is going to go that deep, but that's where I go. And then afterwards, I specifically hone in on that person and I start to ask questions mm-hmm. that are a lot deeper and a lot more personal for them. But when we're all said and done, if I'm the person that's going to be their mouthpiece speaking through illustration, I become their voice. And to become someone's voice, you have to be inside of their frame. I have to be their larynx. I have to be their vocal cords. I have to understand what they're going to say and how they're going to say it and how they want the world to hear them. It's a very personal connection. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where I differentiate between the people that are just making illustration. Here's this happy person holding this product because now they're happy because they have the product. And here's a picture of them holding that product and they're happy. That's not what I'm doing. I'm there to do something different. Just like the people that I'm excited about, the rebels, the misfits, and the pioneers. I'm there for something different.
Yeah. I mean, how does that process of going deep? I mean, that's amazing how deep you go. Yeah. How do you translate that into visual language?
Where that comes from is still analog years. You know, if you take me back to the 90s, when I started my business, my illustration business, working for magazines, at the very beginning, I had been a designer and an art director for quite a while. So I was still connected to the creative scene and, you know, reading a lot of magazines and hearing a lot of stuff about what people thought about different things in the creative field. And the one thing that I kept hearing again and again, especially when they talked about illustrators, was that if you're starting out as an illustrator, only have one style, have one thing that people know you for. And it made total sense. I mean, there were so many fantastic illustrators back then. And if you said their name, I saw an image of what they created in my mind. Mm-hmm. If I needed to, as an art director, if I needed someone to actually create an illustration and there was a specific vision in my mind, I could think of that one person and I know exactly what I'm going to get. So it was all good advice, but it was that advice that I completely ignored. And I thought, if I'm going out on my own, it's insane. No one has heard of me. I'm not going to start with one style and hope that the world likes it, number one, and find a use for it, and that it will remain relevant for decades, because I'm not here to do this for 5 years. I'm here to do this for 30 or 40 or 50. Hmm. And so I went out and I made multiple illustration styles because I could. And it's not just making multiple illustration styles, things that look different from each other, but it's creating each style. I wouldn't release a style until I knew it fully, like in and out. I knew that I could tell any story with it. And so it was a language. I wasn't developing styles. I was developing a language.
Wow.
So now when I'm speaking with people about about a brand illustration system, once we've kind of reached a point where I feel like I know who they are, because that has to be proven. I can't say that I know someone until both of us have put our heads together and I'm putting work in front of them and they're like, yeah, this is exactly what I feel. Mm-hmm. What I'll do is I go back and I do iterations. I'll start creating visual languages that start to come to mind. And I'll create styles for them. And it's a sampling process. You know, here's a sample of this visual, I guess, as a language. It's the best thing I can come up with. It's a visual language for them. And at some stage, we're going to connect on those and we'll know if that's the fit or if it's not. But I have reasons for everything that I do and the work that I make. And so that's where I go from there. It's a long answer, but it comes from a background of actually having done this all along. I just never realized that I would end up working for companies and being their voice. I was just creating multiple illustration styles for all these editorial jobs I got, or the advertising art jobs that I got, or the labeling for, you know, packages and stuff. But I'd been doing it for years, and now I'm able to say that their language is for specific companies.
That's fantastic, because as you say language, I think about like Tolkien, who wrote Lord of the Rings, and how he created languages within the book, like Elvish and right. and all these crazy, like, who does that? Who creates a full-on language?
Right.
But then I'm thinking about you and creating languages that you end up then speaking the client's voice with.
Yeah.
So what are the artifacts of that language development?
Well, probably like any brand system, there's some basics. I think, you know, color is always expressive. Mm-hmm. It's how I'm choosing to use color and why I'm choosing to use those colors. They're all pretty basic. I mean, you've always got human figures in it. You know, there's a possibility that maybe you won't. Mm-hmm. I can't say that that's always a given, but there are, there's line quality. There's the amount of, there's the compositions that you're building. You know, who is this for? Is this for a sports company, or is this for a small manufacturer of whatever? You know, I'm working with a furniture company right now, and we're building some things, and so it's almost like the pieces that I put together are any basic breakdown that you would see in any illustration, except for it's minusing a beating heart. It's the one thing in the Frankenstein's monster that needs to be there, and that's the heart that's beating. Without having that heart in there, all the rest of it is just parts and pieces. And so it could be texture, it could be what I'm saying with it. It could be the proportions of the people that are actually that I'm drawing. You know, what is central? You know, what is always central? It can be iconography. It can be literal, because I do hand lettering as well.
Wow.
So there's so many components, but they really are just components until you start hearing people's stories and you start talking about what's so important about why they started their business, mm-hmm. and who do they want to reach and what do they want to say. And I want to break some conventions. I don't want to relegate myself to just a small portion of their hero page. I might say I'm going to replace all of your copy, all of it. Like I don't want to see any of your copy. Like, because what needs to be said is what we need to say together on a piece of art. And then afterwards we can talk about copy. And if I can't hit that, then let's reexamine what we're doing here, because if I'm starting to feel something that deeply, I'm not going to say it. And if we're not listening to each other and we're not exploring new things, if we're not both asking the question, why not? Mm-hmm. Then, you know, we're probably not in alignment. But by the time I'm working on art and coming up with iterations for them, we've probably reached that level. So yeah. I already know that I can have that conversation with them.
I have to say that when you mention the beating heart and how it's going to be different for each business,
yeah,
that makes so much sense to me. Like, that's an aha moment of just like the way you describe that with the different elements, but finding that beating heart.
Yeah.
Wow. That's powerful. That's really good.
Awesome.
Wow. Because if you don't have that, then you just have elements.
It is. It's just a series of elements. And I feel like at this stage, I can see when people are doing that. And I get it. I mean, I completely get it. Again, I'm not disparaging anyone that's having to do that. It's completely understandable when people have to just get the job done.
Yeah.
But I don't want to be that guy.
One of the interesting things as you're describing this process of developing language and being in business for as long as you have and as long as you want to be, you have an interesting take on curating your artistic and creative archives.
Yeah.
What do your archives look like at this point?
Ooh, wow. So I have never been satisfied, again, with just making one thing, because I do multiple illustration styles and because I'm interested in so many different things. And I've worked with magazines all the way from like kids' magazines to corporate. I've done everything. And sometimes I've done them simultaneously. Wow. I'm working on a kids magazine for one magazine. And I'm working on some sort of a full page illustration for a financial magazine, in the same week, because I have a style for both of them. I mean, they're custom made for those things. Because I can do that, I get really bored doing one thing when I'm on my own. So I'm constantly creating something new. And so I have these small pools of, here's this one thing I got into for 3 or 4 months. And so I have 50 or 60 different pieces of art that I've kind of created and stuck in one corner. And all of a sudden I'm into this thing now, and I'm kind of creating colors, and I'm creating prints, and I'm creating, at one point I started to do food illustration, and I'd never done that before. I thought, this is really interesting. People are doing a lot of that. I wonder if I can do it. Mm-hmm. So I got into that for like maybe 6 months or so. And I have a big pool of all that stuff, and I created products and stuff out of that. So I have all of these different deposits of ideas and styles and things that I want to do that really don't have an outlet, and they've just collected over time. Mm-hmm. And I'll go back to the thing where I said, don't isolate, make sure that you're in contact with people, because it took me being in contact with someone to get their perspective on these little deposits of illustration pieces that I had. Mm-hmm. And we were having a conversation, and they were pushing me towards kind of creating these extra income streams. And I said, here's all the stuff that I've got. I'm just going to send you like all of this stuff that I've got. And they looked through all of it and they said, my God, like when do you stop? When do you sleep? And they said, why aren't you doing something with this? And I said, I don't know what to do with them. Like, I just don't know where to go with this. And so they pulled something out and they said, why don't you work on this? This looks really great. And so I built it and I pulled it together. I curated it. I continued making it. It was one of those fortuitous moments when you run into that one domino, mm-hmm. that hits another domino, that hits another domino, that hits another domino. And it ended up that style that she pulled out of my archives ended up being the reason that I hooked up with a major company in Colorado making furniture. And I not only changed their business and the direction that they're going, but they changed my income level and they changed my future. And they gave me the opportunity to realize that I can do this for more companies. And so I don't know what's left in my archives here, but there's so much more. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the future holds for all of it. But if I can get all my ducks in a row and head in this direction, this is my career 2.0 kind of mm-hmm. move here. And I'm sure that they'll all see the light of day. I'm hopeful that I'll find something to do with it and understand how to operate getting it out into the world. But those are my archives.
Yeah, that's great. Because the thing about any creative pursuit, there's inevitably just that growing catalog, that growing archive. What would you encourage others to do as they are advancing in their career?
As far as illustration, are you in that
vein? Yeah, go ahead and start there. And we'll let the audience extrapolate to their own pursuits.
Yeah, for sure. If you're in the realm of illustration and over time you're collecting ideas and building maybe directions that you don't know fully how to chase down to their final destination, I always made sure that whatever I was making, I knew when I was beginning it and I knew when I ended it, and then I packaged it. Everything is like in a folder. So I made sure that it was all collected in one place, and I kept all my notes about what I was thinking at the time, and that's in the folder.
Wow.
So, and then by the time I felt like I'm moving on to something else, I kind of just stuck it away. And a lot of this stuff is in sketchbooks and, it's just going to come out of the blue. Or maybe I'm collecting stuff online and I'm like, these are really great ideas. I would like to make my own thing out of all of these parts and pieces, or could I make another language out of this? So I've either got physical files or I've got digital files, but I think it's really important to document what you're thinking at the time and how you feel, because it may be a year or two that you spend out in the wilderness before you come back to it. And then you have to refresh yourself about who you were at that point. We're constantly changing. So the person that wrote that note 2 years ago is not the person that's looking at it today. And I have to like reintroduce myself to myself and look at it and just think, wow, yeah, this is still a great idea. And if it lasts that long, you've got something viable.
Yeah, that's not just illustration. That's everything. So well done.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that you didn't know what the future really looks like, but you know, if as you start defining the language of career 2.0, you know, what story are you telling?
Well, the story that I hope to tell mm-hmm. is making why not happen. I don't want to get to the end of my career and have just followed a formula. I'm ready for discovery. I guess the story that I want to tell is that this is possible. I'm not one of those people that says, you know, just because I did it, you can do it too. I don't think that that's true. Because most of the stuff that was the most fortuitous in my life happened to me without me thinking that it was going to happen. So I, you know, your luck may differ.
Yeah.
You may run into it early. You may run into it a little bit later. You may never run into it. And that's really hard to say for people to hear. It may not happen, but don't be the person that doesn't allow it to happen. Keep working at what you're working at and love what you do, because when it does happen, if you don't have those things on hand, it's going to be the fortuitous moment that you are empty-handed. Don't be there. Mm. And the fortuitous moments only happen when you're out of isolation. Like I said, don't let that stuff in your house. That stuff is deadly. It is fire in your house. There's a Charlie Kaufman film called Synecdoche, New York, and it's this oddball little film. And one of the characters in there, her name is Hazel, and she buys a house that is perpetually burning. And throughout the film, whenever she's in her home, there's just fires, active fires going on in her house, and it's smoky. And eventually that smoke through the end of the film ends up being a contributing factor in her death. And it's this odd little film, but it reminds me constantly that if I purchase a house and I allow stagnation and isolation to stay in that house with me, it's as ridiculous as me buying a house that's literally on fire all the time. Like that was the only reason the connections that I made were the ones that brought the most fortune my way, because people know you, people can connect you, people can help you. You can ask questions, you can get, you can get responses, you can get feedback. Always be in a growth mindset and don't be in a fixed mindset. So my story ahead is going to contain all of those things. I want people to succeed, but it's going to take each one of the people out there to make those kind of decisions, good decisions.
Thank you so much. That was incredibly refreshing to hear. Mm-hmm. And I just appreciate you sharing your journey with me today on Getting Work to Work, Matt. Thank you. I mean, this has been beyond what I expected it to be. Thank you.
Oh man, thank you for the opportunity. This is, thank you for being one of the people that I connected with.
Absolutely.
This is that happening right now.
There were many standout moments in this episode, but two I would like to call out and reemphasize. The first one was Matt saying, don't isolate yourself from others. I really love what he said about people needing to know who you are, what you do, what your story is, and hearing your voice. And I think it's important to really keep seeking those relationships and those new connections. The other thing that I've really been thinking about is just the whole concept of the archives. When you work in a digital or analog medium, there's always going to be work that you can catalog and store. But I really love what Matt said about writing down your thoughts and feelings in the moment so that when you return to them a year, 2, 5 years later, you're going to be able to get into your way of thinking, because we're always growing and changing. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Matt. There were so many things. Be sure to check out the show notes page, because I link to everything that he mentioned from the YouTube channels that he was sharing. It's pretty awesome stuff. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.